I'd like to introduce now Alan Wiseman. He is the author of the book, The World Without Us, published by St. Martin's Press. It's wonderful to have you here in the cafe.
Thank you.
This is a work of journalism, and I saw you a few weeks ago on The Daily Show. It's become a very popular book, and it's a work of journalism about an event that hasn't happened yet. That's an unusual thing. You imagine a world in which people have suddenly vanished, not through nuclear war or whatever, but just simply vanished. They've been raptured, or everybody's died of a virus or something like that. And what would happen to the planet without us? What was your inspiration for this?
Well, I have been reporting on the environment all over the world, and I've been doing this for more than 20 years. I have been from pole to pole. You know, I've covered the ozone hole in South America, in Antarctica, and the melting permafrost in the Arctic, and hot spots in between, from burning rainforests to Chernobyl. And I've wanted to write something that brings all this stuff together and explains how it all connects. But it's so daunting for people. Sometimes it's just overwhelming, depressing, even scary. And how do you get your readers to really look at this and understand its urgency and understand that we have to do something about it? So it occurred to me that maybe instead of writing something that people are just going to just slam shut and say, I can't read this because they're scared that we're all going to die, maybe I just kill everybody off in the beginning by imagining something that's only remotely possible, but still enough possible enough that we're not looking at science fiction here. As you mentioned, you know, a Homo sapiens-specific virus, say AIDS were airborne, for example. Or a lot of people do believe in raptures. Clear the decks of us. We could see the rest of the planet much more easily if we removed us and got a chance to look at, okay, if we pull ourselves out of the equation, how would the rest of nature get along without us in our relentless daily pressures? But also, what would we leave behind from all the stuff that we have built to, for example, all the carbon that we've thrown up into the atmosphere? How long would it take for nature to reabsorb that? Could it? If some things that we've done, you know, are they indelible? Well, the fear factor is kind of diffused. People are already dead, but they sort of get to hang around and see the future. And it's not my conjecture. I'm a reporter. The way that you report the future is you go to all these experts all over the world who are seeing all different kinds of things, and you get their best educated guess. And
which is no different from global warming science, which is all about making predictive models, for example.
Of course. And that part of the future is kind of a moving target. I had to pose at least a few different scenarios. At a certain point, you know, I've got a chapter in the book that talks about could or would Manhattan Island revert to a forest the way it was when Henry Hudson first saw it in 1609, and there were just a few indigenous people living along the shores. And in fact, it would. But the kind of forest, it really depends on where the temperature is of the future, and we've got models suggesting that it's going to be a lot warmer. We've got some suggesting that if Greenland melts and closes down the ocean conveyor, we could actually go into some kind of ice age, or at least some very cold regime. And then some people are looking at models that suggest there could be some canceling out effect, which, you know, we just don't know yet.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. Some of the book is devoted to the fate of our houses and of our cities and infrastructures once we're no longer there to take care of it. And I found it so fascinating that these massive structures that we've built in our lives, houses, skyscrapers, bridges, are incredibly vulnerable to little tiny things like microorganisms and bird droppings.
Yeah. The background for this is that I start out the book in a real forest primeval. It's a fragment of old-growth forest that still remains in Europe because it was owned by Polish kings and then Russian czars, and it finally became a national park. And it's sort of like going back into an Eden that we all sort of remember on one level, because it seems oddly familiar to see these huge trees.
And I have to say, it's so fascinating that this Eden was preserved by monarchs and dukes and all that stuff.
You know, it happens here too. The one truly pristine place I've ever been in the lower 48 is on a huge ranch in Arizona that I wrote about. I was not allowed to identify what ranch, and it was in like a 20-mile-long canyon that was bracketed by waterfall on either end, so cows could not get in on either side, and the sides were too steep for burros to get down into it. And this whole thing was under private lock and key. So there's a history of this kind of stuff. But once I get people remembering, you know, that, yes, there's something in these old places that is what we hearken to. Then I had to look at what has walled us off from nature, and then I had to tear down those walls. So I start inside of houses and show how houses without maintenance would go down really quickly. And, you know, wood frame houses, I mean, here in Santa Fe, you've got a lot of adobe, but you've also got a lot of faux adobe that are really, plastered,
wood
frame houses.
Yeah.
And it'll start on the roof, usually around the chimney or around the skylights. If you're not maintaining the house, water will eventually leak in and it'll start to run down those sheathing, those 4x8 sheets. And even if they're made out of this new wood chipboard that's got impregnable resin, the water will get in through the nail holes. And then, enzymes have developed over the world, over history, that can eat wood, and they will start to do it. And within 50 years, easily, the sheathing will become loose, and that will loosen up the trusses below that, and those little connector plates will start to rust, and once the walls start to leak, just a hole in the roof. There's a guy at the beginning of my book who says, you want to tear down a barn, cut a 18-inch square, 18-inch square hole in the roof and just stand back, and it'll go fast. As for cities, I went to New York because it's kind of the epitome of an urban area. We just can't imagine all that concrete and steel ever being invaded by nature. But subway engineers took me below the city and showed me how it would happen. Manhattan used to be very hilly. There were streams and rivers running along the surface, over 40. And then when they smashed down those hills and buried those rivers to superimpose the grid on the city, they put in a sewer system, but sewers cannot do what nature does. They can't mimic it perfectly. So there's all this groundwater rushing underneath the city. And if they don't keep nearly 800 pumps going all the time, the subways will flood.
So day one, we're raptured. Day two, the subways are full of water.
The subways would be filled with water by day three. And then this columns that are holding up the streets would start to corrode. And within a couple of decades, they would start to collapse. And then the streets would start to crater, and then there would be rivers on the surface again. In the meantime, plants are invading the city very quickly. They're always getting into cracks in the sidewalk. They blow around in the springtime, seeds are, and they will. I have seen in some places, just flowers will crack apart concrete. Also, nobody is going to be cleaning the innumerable plastic bags that will end up clogging drains, and then you'll get all this leaf litter in cities where no one's raking the leaves, and that will form mulch in the gutters of streets where seeds will start to germinate, and tree trunks will actually appear. Tree trunks, they grow fast. I've seen stuff in Manhattan, like on the High Line, which is an abandoned railway trestle, which never had soil. It's two stories above ground, where there's apple trees and ailanthus trees growing right now, and they're just growing in airborne soot that's settled onto the cinders along the tracks.
Amazing.
It's fabulous.
One of the things that I thought about so much while reading this book, especially the part about civilization, about what happens to cities, is how incredibly much work it takes to keep apparently stable structures in place. I was particularly struck by the whole description of the George Washington Bridge in your book, for example.
Yeah, I had a wonderful time with one of the bridge engineers who has been in charge of several of the big bridges that link Manhattan and Staten Island to the mainland. And he says we are in a constant battle against nature, and it's a battle that we will ultimately lose. It's just not going to happen on my watch, is what he says. But a bird, and this happens all the time, flying over the bridge will drop a seed, and that enough bird poop will be around that seed that it'll lodge into a crack between two big, thick steel plates, and it'll germinate and it'll start to push them apart. And then if these guys weren't maintaining the bridges, keeping them painted, they would start to rust. Now, they won't rust all the way through. The rust kind of forms a protective coating over the steel, but it takes up a lot more room. So in between two steel plates, water penetrates, that rust has got to expand, and it'll just push them apart, and it'll pop off the rivets. And on the ends of the bridge, metal bridges have to expand and contract with temperature, and if there's no place to expand because the expansion joints fill up with rust and debris and stuff like that that nobody's cleaning out. The bridge will just pop its bolts at the ends and it'll start to walk. You know, we owe so much to the people who maintain the subways dry and show up at the power plants and keep these bridges up there. You know, I realized after going all over the world and interviewing hundreds of people for this book that I didn't interview any policymakers or politicians. They actually don't have an awful lot to do with the stuff of life. But we get rid of these people who are doing the work behind the scenes and underneath the ground for us, and everything would collapse. We owe them an enormous amount.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. The book is called The World Without Us. Archaeologists dig up cities. What is the mechanism by which cities get covered over in the first place, that they have to be dug up? And how would that happen if we vanished instantaneously?
Well, of course, it depends on where you are in the world. You know, in arid ecosystems, cities don't get buried by foliage as quickly as, say, in the tropical jungles. I mean, you know, Mayan civilization disappeared within a couple hundred years underneath just a tangle of jungle. And at one point in this book, I do accompany some archaeologists into Mayan Guatemala. And there, for over 1,000 years, nobody knew this stuff was there. And they were hiking me over ridges and over hills that their expert eyes could see were actually walls and pyramids. On the other hand, here in the desert, you know, stuff will last a little longer. But wherever you have rivers, and most desert cities are built along rivers, and we've built right up to their floodplains. Well, in the future, even though we're in a drought regime right now, if there were no human beings here maintaining everything, one of the things that would go within a couple hundred years, or actually a lot less in most cases, are all the dams that we have on all the rivers. They would silt up and they would spill over, or water like a Glen Canyon up, you know, in Four Corners, Arizona. It's always trying to come around the dam and carve out the sandstone. But as water spills over dams, when, you know, so much stuff piles up against them, a waterfall will just dig out a hole right in front of the dam. The stuff will flop over. And then those rivers will periodically flood. So I was just in Tucson, and all of its new renovated downtown area is built along the Santa Cruz, which is dry now because it doesn't get past Nogales, Sonora, this huge border city that sucks so much water out, or the dams in the alluvial field, or the wells in the alluvial field around Tucson. That river starts flowing again. Rain hits the mountains, flash floods. It's going to cover an awful lot of the city with silt.
It's interesting that even in dry areas like Santa Fe, like New Mexico, water would flow so much more in such a greater quantity just because we're not taking it out to water our fields and to have our houses, you know, have showers, do our dishes, and so on.
Oh, sure. And plus, you know, the history of Arizona and New Mexico is that, you know, around the 1880s, there was an enormous population explosion of cattle. You know, and back then, the Navajo reservation was like knee-high in grass. That was much of what we saw here. Beautiful riparian areas around the beautiful rivers of the Southwest. And, you know, a lot of that foliage is gone, and erosion, you know, has turned these rivers into just broad flats now. Well, all of that would be restored. I was privileged.
We would have grasslands again in New Mexico.
You know, in 1983, it was when I was first starting out, I had the privilege to be down in the Colorado Delta, where the Colorado River runs into Mexico and, you know, goes to the Sea of Cortez. And so much snow fell in the Rockies that year, they had to open all the floodgates and Hoover Dam and Glen Canyon Dam, because they were going to lose the dams otherwise. The Colorado, again, reached the sea. Today it doesn't. And suddenly, cottonwood saplings started coming up everywhere, and sea bass, the totoava that everybody thought was extinct, started showing up again in the masses that used to live there. You know, all the nutrients from really carved out the Grand Canyon and dump them into the sea there. It was an incredibly rich body of water. Breeding shrimp were popping up out of the, like popcorn, coming up out of the water. And all this vegetation, it's pretty terrific how quickly nature can recolonize. And that's kind of a message that comes through my book. I go to many contaminated areas, Chernobyl itself. Life is so resilient. It always finds a way to come back. And it's made me realize that I'm not so much worried for the planet anymore. No matter what we're doing to it, Earth's going to come out fine. Now the question is what we can continue to be a part of it.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. The book is called The World Without Us. Alan Wiseman, you said just a moment ago, the Earth will be okay without us. Nature is resilient. But there's also something that you called in your book ticking time bombs or toxic time bombs, petroleum tanks, nuclear power plants, mercury, chromium, various other things. What happens to these when they are untended? I mean, they're already partly untended now. Accidents can happen. Human beings go away. What happens?
Well, we're going to have some messes out there. And in the short term, there are some dramatic events that may be forthcoming. In the long grand scale of things, geologic time, I think that the planet will recover because it's gone through a lot of really severe stuff in the past. There have been huge asteroid crashes and all sorts of things. But some of the stuff that will happen, well, we have a lot of chemical plants. And I went to the Grand Petroscape between Houston and Galveston, which is the biggest concentration of tanks and flares and cracking towers and pipelines and stuff in the world, to ask, well, what was here before all of this, and could it come back? So I spent a lot of time with ecologists, but I also spent time inside of petroleum plants and chemical plants. And the petroleum infrastructure is actually more vulnerable than I thought it would be. I mean, it still really corrodes. And a lot of the pipes that run all over everywhere, these are second, third generation versions of those pipes because so many of them have corroded. Tanks have about a 20-year lifespan. So if humans weren't here minding the store, that stuff would corrode. And then what's in it would leak out. Now, it depends. If humans left and banked the fires and closed down the plants before they did go, most of that stuff would be kind of goop. And there are a lot of microbes now that have learned how to eat that goop. And it would be messy. There'd be some globs that float into the Gulf of Mexico, but eventually it would get processed out. It's possible, though, that if humans just took off or were raptured away, shall we say, and the fires were still burning, there would probably be some fires. And some of the people in the petroleum industry said, well, look, you know, we've got all these fail-safe mechanisms, so if one plant does have an explosion, it never spreads to another plant, which is largely true. But if no one's there monitoring the computers that take care of those fail-safe mechanisms, and we could see a big cloud of smoke come out of that whole chemical alley, Texas to Louisiana, etc. Radioactive plants, that's a deeper concern to me because we've had one Chernobyl, and we know that it burned and it melted down and it sent a lot of radiation into the air, 100 times more than Hiroshima, at least. There's 440 nuclear plants in the world, and a lot of them have multiple reactors. And their fail-safe mechanism is the plant will shut down if there's no humans there monitoring them. But then emergency generators kick in to keep the water circulating around the reactor cores. They're run by diesel. When the diesel runs out, then that still water around the reactor core will become evaporated from the reactor's heat. And when it's exposed, the reactor will either burst into flames, or if it's got a lot of fuel left in it, it'll probably melt down. And that's going to be a lot of Chernobyls for the world to contend with.
440-plus Chernobyls.
Well, Chernobyl actually had six nuclear plants and only, you know, six reactors, only one of them burned. So you have to multiply that 440 by the number of actual reactors. Now, Chernobyl is real interesting. When you go there today, you see a profusion of wildlife. There's a 30-kilometer evacuated zone around it, and the biodiversity is much higher inside that zone than it is outside, where there are still people. But it's still very radioactive in there, and the first genetic studies are being done on some of the species, and the results are kind of mixed. Birds seem to be suffering, and though they are fledging, I saw swallows nesting when I was there. A lot of them are being born with obvious genetic defects. There's white flecks on them, and they seem to be weakened, and they're living shorter lifespans. But then there's a population of voles also living abbreviated lifespans, but they're sexually maturing earlier, and they're having a lot more babies than before, which I think is nature's way of responding to a dramatic change in the environment. Kick out a whole, you know, a bunch more examples, among which there might be some that have either a recessive gene or a mutation that might be a little bit more resistant to radiation. The strongest will survive, and that's the way the evolutionary line will go in the future. Now, at a certain point, if we do too much to nature, some species won't be able to evolve to compensate at all. They will just disappear. That's happened in time immemorial. It certainly happened to the dinosaurs when the asteroid hit the Yucatan area and kicked up something that they could not tolerate. But each time that that has happened, a huge cataclysm, be it an enormous volcanic eruption like the one that touched off the Permian extinction 250 million years ago, 90% of all species died, to the dinosaurs asteroid, to us, nature just keeps coming back. A lot of stuff died. It never comes back, but new stuff comes. And it's really exciting how creative life is.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. The book is called The World Without Us. I read the whole thing. It is a page-turner. I mean, I think that's one of the fascinating things about this book is that you are reaching a very broad audience with this book who wouldn't probably otherwise be reading science journalism or nature journalism.
Well, that was absolutely my intention. I've written lots of articles and I've done a lot of stuff for public radio over the year about the environment. And, you know, articles help keep people informed who are already really aware of this stuff. But I wanted a book to be just an exciting read that would go way beyond that audience who already knows an awful lot about this. And, like I say, just as you said, keep them turning the pages. And this interesting mechanism that does kind of put the fear behind us and yet is so fascinating because I ran into incredible people all over the world who showed me really interesting things. I mean, and stuff that I hadn't thought about. You know, I thought about how, you know, would our fields, our agricultural fields, be recolonized by forests. But then I realized, you know, at first I looked at some of these old, old fields that have turned into forests again, but then they were never fertilized before. So I found a place where fertilizers were patented in England, and they did test strips 160 years ago that have been going ever since. And all these different combinations, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, municipal sludge, they add that to a whole combination of different crops, rotated crops, monocultures, or sometimes just letting it go and seeing what comes in naturally. And, you know, it's not easy to write in an interesting way about agriculture, but there was a tremendous...
But you do it.
Well, thank you very much.
I mean, even to the point where genetically modified organisms, which we have, they become part of the system and they start to evolve as well.
Well, actually, I think that most of our genetically modified crops aren't going to do all that well because they are dependent on a lot of chemical inputs. They were developed in laboratories. They didn't evolve through the ecosystem. But yeah, here and there, there's something that has proved, you know, surprisingly resilient. I mean, surprises are what always happens. And, you know, people have oftentimes said, so if we go, what will take our intelligence niche, you know, what's going to come next? And the answer, there's lots of answers because how do we define intelligence, of course. But the real answer is that nobody knows what's going to happen because every time there's been an evolutionary crash, something has shown up totally surprising. Doug Irwin from the Smithsonian, who also comes here to teach at Santa Fe Institute a lot, a great extinction expert, said to me, you know, 200 million years ago, any zoologist who would have predicted the evolution of the turtle would have been laughed out of town. I mean, who would have thought that some creature would turn its shoulder harness inside out and create a carapace, and yet it's been incredibly successful. So the surprises are enormous. What we do know is that a lot of our introduced species, you know, because we've exchanged species across the continent.
Species that are not native to a particular place.
Exactly. And a lot of them will get outcompeted by the native species given the chance. But then a whole lot of them are here to stay. And rather than mourn that, some ecologists have told me that, you know, even though we like native species, it's what's really important is that we have a functioning ecosystem that's filtering the water and that's holding the soil in place and that's refreshing the air. And even some of what we consider wilderness, like the Brazil nut groves in the Amazon or the durian fruit trees in Indonesia or tea trees in Burma, those are signs of old civilizations. They're gone completely, but their echo remains in the forest, and it's beautiful.
I thought that was so fascinating, that there are places where there's not a single trace of the human hand in the form of pottery or bronzes or things that seem to last for a long time, and yet you can tell, or bones or anything, and yet you can tell there were humans there because of a couple of trees.
Right, and when nature takes our history and kind of smooths off the rough edges of it, I think it does show that we have created some beautiful things and we have made contributions. I mean, birds spread seed around too. Granted, we're doing it in sort of a jet-propelled way these days, and our reach is, you know, far too voracious. And ultimately, that's what this book, The World Without Us, is about. I mean, I want people to see what it would be like without us, to see how much it could heal, and then figure out, okay, how can we add ourselves back, and so we can be in much more harmony and balance with the Earth. But we have done beautiful things. We have created art. You mentioned pottery and bronze. I mean, some of that stuff will last a long time. Pottery is chemically similar to a fossil, and bronze is one of our most durable elements. Even though I have a whole chapter about how long plastics will last, which is pretty scary because nothing knows how to eat them, I like the idea of Rodin sculptures lasting throughout time. Yeah.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. The book is called The World Without Us. Even though you are looking forward, Alan Wiseman, to a time without us, you're also looking back for example, to a time in North America, right here where we are sitting today in the cafe. There were huge animals, mastodons, giant armadillos, glyptodonts, huge bears, giant beavers the size of bears, woolly mammoths. I read this list just because I found it so interesting, and you have actually illustrations of some of these animals in your book. They were here on the North American continent. Large animals still survive in Africa. They did not survive in this place. Why not?
Well, coincidentally, the arrival of humans seems to have touched off an extinction of large herbivores on all the other land masses. And it happened in Australia because humans showed up there about 50,000 years ago, and then about 13,000 years ago when people came here to stay. They may have come earlier, but we know that there was a big migration across the Siberian passage. Within 1,000 years, enormous numbers of creatures were extinct. We had three times the number of animals, a ton or more, animal species, a ton or more, than Africa has today. Now, the reason they're still in Africa, and I went to Africa to feel what it was like to be in a landscape with human, with large beings. Well, those animals evolved alongside humans because we are all Africans originally, and they learn sort of evasive techniques to deal with the newest predator on the block. But then that raised the question for me, well, why did humans evolve in the first place? I mean, we were up there with our common ancestor of the chimpanzee and the bonobo. I mean, why did we branch off? And it turns out, as ecologists explained to me, that at the time when this happened, around 7-8 million years ago, there were continual ice ages all over the world, and so much moisture was locked up in the ice that Africa was going through droughts. There were fewer forest resources, so there was a lot of competition to see who got to stay in the forest and eat the fruits or eat the other things. Monkeys are, or chimpanzees eat monkeys, they're carnivores too, or omnivores. And eventually some things just sort of lost and they got kicked out, and that was our ancestors. We think of ourselves as these great visionaries who started, you know, we're going to march across the savannah and across the horizon, but frankly, your ancestor and mine were one of the lucky survivors who literally learned to stand on his own 2 feet and see over the grass and evade that lion that was running at him. But eventually, you know, humans, the ones that survived, were very successful adapters. And, well, look at us today. Maybe a little too successful.
What would happen, I just have to ask you this, to domestic animals? Dogs, cats, goats, livestock, and so on. What's their chance of survival? I mean, the teacup poodles probably aren't quite going to make it.
I don't think our dogs are going to be able to outcompete coyotes and wolves. There might be some interbreeding.
As there is now, as you mentioned,
yeah,
coyotes and wolves.
They are interbreeding, yes. The wolves, the coyotes that are moving from the west to the east coast, they're going up across the Great Lakes, and in Canada, they are interbreeding with wolves. There's some genetic evidence of that. our cows would not do well at all. They are basically these redesigned digestion machines. They're slow, they're plodding. They'll be lunch for predators. Horses, very interesting. They originated in North America. They were killed off among the other megafauna, but by then they had migrated to other lands, and then Columbus and Coronado brought them back here, and now, you know, the BLM goes crazy because of all these wild burros and wild horses in the Great Basin and stuff, and, you know, like, they don't belong here, so there's, you know, attempts to adapt them out or to shoot them, but I think this is wonderful. This is an animal that has rediscovered, you know, it's re-entered its niche, our equine niche that was empty in North America. Another animal that we brought that is going to do very well is the house cat. It's genetically identical to a small wild cat that lives around the Mediterranean on three continents. I don't think we've ever domesticated it. It just considers us a very easy niche in the ecosystem. We bring it food, we give it shelter, but you put a cat outside, even if it's just been fed, it'll hunt again. And here it found this songbird-sized niche. And feral cats, both in the alleyways of our cities and out there in the farmyards, they've got a huge population. They are out competing in many ways other competitors like weasels, animals that are also carnivores out there. House cats are here to stay, just like the mongooses and the wild pigs in the South Sea Islands. Polynesians brought them, and the mongoose was brought in to control a rat that the Polynesians brought. Those animals are well established.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. The book is called The World Without Us. What do you think would happen to human populations, human civilization, if we didn't disappear, but our population was literally decimated? We went down to one-tenth of the population on the Earth that we are now.
Well, you know, it may happen. Every species in geologic history that has reached the end of its resource base suffers a population crash, and we keep stretching ours with more agricultural technology, but that stuff gets very vulnerable. You know, at the farm I mentioned to you before, the research station, when they just let these fields go, wheat, you know, the next year there's only half of it in the field, and then the year after that there's like a couple of straggler plants, and then it's gone.
Yeah, 4 years, gigantic wheat fields turn into no wheat at all.
Exactly. They turn into some local, you know, local species. Also, we have, you know, scraped away a lot of tropics to grow food for us, and that's causing other problems because it's ruining the habitat for a lot of our migrating species who help pollinate our crops. So, you know, we sooner or later we're at the end of our resource base. But at the end of this book, I mean, one of the reasons I think this book has been so popular and reached a wide audience is that I don't preach in it anywhere. I don't tell people, you know, here's what we have to do, we have to be more environmentally conscious. There are a lot of good books who talk about that. My role was to just clear the deck so we could see the world a little more clearly. Well, at the very end, though, I do bring up something that I think has left the conversation in the past several years that we should think about, which is, well, let's put it this way. I pose another little fantasy, another thought experiment at the end. Suppose instead of humans disappearing, humans continued on. But from now on, instead of procreating the way we do, we only had one child per family. And I tried to get a hold of the zero population growth to run the numbers on this. Couldn't find them. They've been run out of the United States, but for political pressures, or they changed their name or something. In Europe, I found demographic institutes who ran the numbers for me. At the end of the 19th century, we had 1.6 billion people. At the end of the 20th century, 6.6 billion people. We're now headed to 9 billion people by the middle of the century. But if we had only one child per family, through attrition, we'd be back down to 1.6 billion within a century. And that, I think, would just create a lot more room for everything else to live.
Now, if we don't do that, things like war, plague, famine, would those do the work of what we could otherwise be doing voluntarily?
Well, in the case, every time there's ever been a war, or the Spanish flu or something like that, some big academic, the population eventually bounces back just as hard, because those were not voluntary. And we were devastated by the losses and by the death, and it's very sad. If we were controlling the population and bringing it down because public will decided worldwide that we have to do this, otherwise something's going to do it for us, and that's not going to be pretty, then I'd like to think that it would be different. You know, it's just like the original Americans who came here and decimated all these large creatures, they learned after a while, oops, this is not a good idea. We lose our food source. And now they have become some of the most ecologically aware people who we look to, you know, these indigenous voices. Well, we're now all indigenous people realizing that if you do too much, suddenly you run out of stuff. And now we all have to figure out, gain the wisdom to figure out how to manage the future. I realize one child per family is a very tough thing to swallow for a lot of us. I mean, I'm the second child of my family. But
I'm an only child, and it's no big deal.
Well, good for you, and good for your parents. But, and you know, I'm not saying anybody alive should feel guilty for having a lot of kids. It's beautiful. I have a lot of friends who have them, and I adore them. But, you know, I mean, look at Italy. This is a country, very Catholic country. They're down to almost one child per family. The Italians have figured out we're more prosperous, or we live better lives, and there's more of that great, you know, bread and wine and truffles and cheese to go around. For whatever reason, they have a prosperous economy, and they've got a happy society that we love to go visit because it's so much fun there, and they have brought their population down into reasonable levels. And that's what we have to be thinking about. It's a conversation we have to have.
To achieve population reduction in the way that you're talking about, you'd have to have a huge education campaign, you'd ultimately have to have an enforcement campaign, and you'd also have to have an economic system that was based on something other than growth if your population was shrinking.
Well, I totally agree, and I don't get into that in my book. The book would have been endless, but I can recommend Bill McKibben's book that I just read, Deep Economy. He really talks about how the economy can flourish as a cycle rather than as a constantly expanding chain letter. You know, the Chinese, you know, have tried one child per family, and there have been a lot of really bad repercussions. You know, obviously it's been terrible for some little girl babies who got abandoned. But
and who've been adopted by people who live all around us.
But, you know, like I say, there are some opportunities in all these things. People who can't have children or want to have more children have an opportunity to adopt children who are unwanted. And the Chinese experiment has been very helpful to show us what some of the pitfalls are that we are going to... And that's what experimentation is for, to learn from. And as you say, a big education, it won't be easy. But, you know, running our entire world, including all our vehicles, with renewable energy, that won't be easy either. We don't have mature enough technologies yet. And we don't even know. You know, fusion is constantly 30 years in the future. But, you know, this is something that we could start doing now. And I think we're going to have to do a lot of things to have our world and us to live in it, too. But, you know, the fewer people on Earth, the more space there will be. And no matter what your politics are, you remember a time when you could go out and there was this beautiful field or tree. It was a place where you hiked or a place where you hunted. And today, it's a bunch of condos, industrial parks. Nobody wants that, no matter what they believe. That's what I have found. And that's why this vision is, I think, a lot of people are calling this a strangely comforting book.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman. The book is called The World Without Us. I have to say, there's a sense of relief that I felt in imagining the world without us, because I love nature, I love animals, and all of these things that we are so threatening to. And yet there's also this question that arises about our place in the great chain of being. We are able to imagine in a way that apparently no other creatures are, even to the point where we're able to imagine our own absence. And I wondered if this led to a whole contemplation for you about our place spiritually, physically on this planet.
Well, absolutely. You know, the reaction I got from lots of people when they asked me, what are you working on? And I said, you know, a world without people. They would say, oh, God, that sounds so great. And then they would think about it and they would say, yeah, but, you know, wouldn't it be a shame if for nature to be in full flower that we'd have to go, because we also do these lovely things. And we start thinking about our ability to envision the future or just to be visionary. And yet we have to learn from it, obviously. Well, I didn't want this book to turn into a spiritual book, because it could have, again, been endless. But I would have been remiss not to look to see what the great religions, many religions, think about what would happen to the planet without us, because so many people are believers. And they would be saying, yeah, but, you know, what does the church say about this? So I interviewed a whole lot of people. I interviewed rabbis, evangelical Christians, Buddhist monks in Korea, Sufi clerics, Muslims in Turkey. I interviewed the Dalai Lama, and I got a whole lot of different answers. You know, a lot of great religions, such as Islam and Christianity, believe that this world was created for humans, and after we're gone, no more world. And yet I was very comforted by some strong evangelicals of both of those religions who said, yes, we believe the world is going to end, it'll be gone, and it'll happen possibly soon, but we don't know when. It's God's time, not ours. And in the meantime, just as we have to keep our bodies pure for prayer, we should be keeping this planet a beautiful creation the way God made it, and a temple for to receive God when God returns. Well, their worldview is a lot different from mine, but the outcome, I think, is one that we could all literally live with together.
Well, do you see that vision as being more about stewardship, or more about just leaving nature alone to do its thing?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, because real stewardship means that we find our place on this planet, and we occupy, but we give nature plenty of room to do what it's going to do. Now, eventually we will go extinct, because every species in history has gone extinct, just like everybody dies eventually.
Well, the sun turns red and...
Well, but long before that, I think that we will be gone, and the Earth will go through many more cycles of life and many more surprising things. You know, age of dinosaurs, age of mammals, who knows who's next or what's next. But in the meantime, the idea of life going on, to me, is a wonderfully comforting idea, and it is to many of my readers, whether we're gone or not, the idea that we have been part of a pageant, and that life force, which is really so mysterious, that whether you're a scientist or a theologian, you have to look at it with awe and reverence, that we are part of it a lot. I mean, I have come to some real peace in researching this book. Yes, I would love to preserve the environment, and I've been fighting as a journalist to inform people all my career about what is precious that we want to hold on to. But like I said before, the Earth will be fine. Whether we get to be part of it or whether we go prematurely because we've knocked too many other things off the planet prematurely, that remains to be seen. But I think that we do have an opportunity to envision, as you said, and maybe we'll choose the right thing.
Alan Wiseman, thank you so much for being with us.
What a pleasure. Thank you.